From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Josh Heyer, and you're listening to the In the Moment Arts Podcast. Each week, In the Moment with Lori Walsh brings you news and arts coverage from across the state. You can listen live at 11 a.m. Central, 10 Mountain on SDPB Radio, or ask your smart speaker to play SDPB. And you can find every In the Moment segment at listen.sdpb.org or subscribe to our In the Moment Segments podcast. Now here's your weekly roundup in arts coverage.
Now this next guest is an expert regarding suffrage in the Dakota Territory. She joined Lori to talk about the first of the suffrage efforts in the territory, which at first also included parts of Wyoming and Montana. Enjoy.
Today, we continue our look at that history by welcoming Lori Ann Lalum to the program. She's professor and graduate program coordinator for the Department of History at Minnesota State University in Mankato, and she is co-author of the book Equality at the Ballot Box, Votes for Women on the Northern Great Plains. And she joins us now on the phone. Welcome, Professor. We appreciate your time.
Well, thank you. I'm thrilled to be here, Lori.
I think a lot of people might be surprised about how far back this conversation about women voting in our region goes. Before we get started with some details, tell me a little bit about your interest in this. You wrote this book with Molly Rosem, who's been a guest on this program as well, and I'm sure will be again. Why study women's suffrage? What kind of drew you into this?
Well, by training, I do Western women's gender and sexuality's history, and so I've always been interested in women in the West. And I attended a session at an Organization of American Historians conference where there was a discussion about the Washington State Woman Suffrage Centennial and the kinds of things they were doing. And it occurred to me, because of the Northern Great Plains History Conference and the fact that I've been long involved with the Northern Great Plains History Conference, as has Molly, that there needed to be something done there to try to generate interest in commemorating this milestone. Of course, recognizing the problems with the amendment. And so that's actually how I started doing research on women's suffrage, because I started organizing these sessions, starting with roundtables at the Northern Great Plains History Conference, and it just kind of grew from there. I will add that the book is the brainchild of Nancy Coble Tysted. I had lower ambitions. I thought a special issue of all of the State Historical Society journals in the area of the Northern Great Plains History Conference in South Dakota was on board with that. But then Nancy said, you know what, why not do a book? And so it's been wonderful working with Molly on this project.
Yeah, it's a fabulous book, and it's really helping me walk through this year and learning some history that I didn't know. And let's go back, because I'm looking at some stuff that you have written. And Dakota Territory organized in 1861. Take us back to the sort of beginnings. When does the conversation about women, you know, being able to vote even start surfacing?
Well, the political discussion, and I'm framing it as political discussion because I'm sure conversations took place, you know, at club meetings and in households and things like that. But the political discussion began in 1868, which was earlier than I thought when we started working on this project. A lot has been, well, I shouldn't say a lot, but it's usually noted that women's suffrage nearly passed the Dakota Territorial Legislature in 1872. And so when I started looking through the actual journals of the House and the Council, I was somewhat surprised to learn that, in fact, there had been legislation introduced in 1868.
So this is, you know, what women are here then at this point? How many women are even part of this conversation? And who are they? And when I say what women are here, clearly that is a complex question because there are many Indigenous women here at this point, and we're primarily at this point talking about white women who have come to this region. So talk a little bit about who is here and how are they part of the conversation.
Well, a lot of the women, they're actually unknown, or at least we have an uncovered sources identifying these women. There are references about women being engaged in the conversation in terms of what was taking place in the legislature. Some of it is done quite facetiously, that no, women really aren't interested. But there have been comments made that women were, in fact, or at least some women were unhappy, white women were unhappy when this legislation wasn't enacted. But unfortunately, there aren't names that are listed. One of the early accounts of this that provides some detail is provided by Alice Pickler in terms of fleshing out the story a little bit. Because if you look at the what appears in the journal for the House and the Council, there's very little that actually is said. The newspapers provide a little more context, but I think there are lots of suffrage questions that still remain to be answered.
When we're looking at 1868, you mentioned, you know, sort of, you know, facetiousness. I want to ask you about this sense of, you know, mischief making or mocking. You know, were the efforts to sort of include women in voting that early serious efforts, or were they kind of a joke?
Well, there is some question about that. It appears that the bill that passed the House may have in fact been a serious effort to give women the right to vote. Why Anna Stutzman introduced the legislation, we don't know. I looked and looked and looked and have not been able to find any collection of his papers. He actually died when he was relatively young, so that could be part of it. He was also a bachelor, so perhaps, you know, his papers weren't preserved. So it's not exactly clear why he introduced the legislation. He was at the time a representative in the House from the Pembina district, and he had advocated for hiring a woman customs agent. Now, it's a little bit complicated. Did he really believe in kind of the idea that women could and should have this kind of position? Or is it because he was advocating for a close friend and he lived, in fact, with this woman's family? So there's a lot that we don't know as to why he introduced it. It seems that the council bill is more problematic because the chief proponent of that was actually a well-known brewer from Yankton. And the fact that the bill that passed the council was defeated by those who supported woman suffrage, for the most part, including Stutzman, in the House, seems to imply that there was something problematic with that House bill. I've looked and looked. Perhaps they exist somewhere, the wording of the legislation, but I haven't been able to find it. The journal doesn't actually include the wording of the legislation, just the name of the bill, it was introduced, who's voting for it, who's voting against it. It's pretty bare bones.
Yeah. When you have you know, the early days of and few white women coming to be part of this male, you know, contingency here in Dakota Territory, there can be a sense of doing more. You know, restrictions that might have applied in a city might not apply out here. Does it frustrate you to not have more of their history, to not have more of their papers and their memories? That you know, what do you wish that you could find that you can't find as a historian?
Well, actually, what I wish that I could find more primary sources from immigrant women. Because actually the South Dakota State Historical Society has a pretty robust collection because of the Alice Pickler papers and USD has the Mamie Shields pile papers. So there are some really nice collections that exist that are very broad in South Dakota, unlike North Dakota, which suffrage records are few and far between in North Dakota. So there is quite a bit that exists, but of course we would like to know more. We would also like to know more about Indigenous women and suffrage. There are some, you know, tantalizing evidence of some engagement with woman suffrage in South Dakota, but that's a story that needs to be fleshed out. I'll also add that when mentioning the introduction of that 1868 bill, it's probably good to remember the time period. This is Reconstruction in the United States, but the year before, Congress had changed a law which made it illegal for territorial constitutions to prohibit African American men from voting. And Dakota Territory, after the law was enacted, very quickly changed the constitution of Dakota Territory to include suffrage for African American men, whereas Montana resisted making that move. So there is kind of something, you know, in the 1860s that seems to be going on in this area.
So my daughter is voted for the first time in this upcoming primary election, and we did the, you know, paper ballots, the absentee ballots here during the pandemic. One of the, you know, choices she had to make was for school board. And I thought that was rather interesting because to us, you know, to her, it was like, well, school board, you know, I don't know much about it. She had to do some research. The idea of women voting in a school board election is pretty important early on. Tell me a little bit about how early is that one of the drivers for including women in the vote?
Yeah, and that's the earliest. This idea that school is an extension of motherhood, if you will, of the domestic sphere, and that women should have a voice in educating children. The first law in the United States was in 1838. It wasn't all women. There were qualifications on women, but it was in Kentucky that women could vote on school matters if they paid taxes and some other things. But it's really the 1870s where there's a huge increase in the number of states and territories that to some degree allow women the right to vote in school issues. And in Dakota Territory, it's kind of complicated. Ruth Page Jones has done a wonderful job kind of teasing out that complicated school suffrage issue. But at the end of the day, the reason why school suffrage is so important is because by voting in those school elections, women demonstrated that they could vote, that they were, you know, educated voters, and it provided this groundwork, this foundation for making an argument for broader voting rights.
Tell us a little bit about what happens next. We're going to have just about a minute left, and we're going to have these conversations all summer long. I hope that we'll have you back as well. But after that sort of that early evidence in our remaining minute, what's the next big leap forward in this conversation?
Well, 1885, and that is fascinating. We'll maybe have to talk about that another time, because 1885 is the year that Dakota Territory should have gotten the right to vote for white women. And I say that because the territorial legislature passed the bill, both houses, and then the governor vetoed it. And there was a lot of heartache over the veto of that legislation. Susan B. Anthony was still upset about it in the early 20th century that Governor Pierce had vetoed the bill.
Thank you.
Now, this next author just finished her debut memoir, Fairest. It's one of the most anticipated literary debuts of the year, and she joined us on Thursday for this discussion.
Fairest is the story of a boy from a rural Philippine village born with albinism that offers both challenge and opportunity, who grows up to be an American woman. It's a remarkable reflection on identity and culture, longing and belonging. Meredith Tillousen is an award-winning author and journalist. She's the founding executive editor of Them, that's Condé Nast's LGBTQ+ digital platform, and she is currently a contributing editor there. Meredith, welcome to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. It's my pleasure.
I'm a fan of your work, and I was thrilled to see that you had this memoir coming out. It's a challenging time to celebrate a book's publication because of what it's done to book tours and stuff. So first of all, congratulations, because I hope you're taking some time to just enjoy the launch of this book.
Absolutely. And as a Filipino person, we're used to dealing with a lot of adversity. And so we always try to find the silver lining. And there have been many, actually, including the fact that friends and family from the Philippines were able to attend my launch, which they otherwise wouldn't have been able to.
Nice. Are there ways that authors are kind of finding that, to reach readers that are, you know, for example, I don't think you were planning a trip to South Dakota, and, you know, readers in South Dakota can do the same thing. They can find some of these in-depth author interviews online and connect with you in new ways. Is that rewarding for you, too, to reach some of these new audiences?
Yeah. It's absolutely wonderful to be able to, you know, talk to people from all over the world, all over the country. And it's absolutely true, even though I absolutely pitched to be able to come to South Dakota, in part because I know the trans issues are really live there. Yes, like it's often the case that, you know, economically it's very difficult to convince publishers to sort of like not center on really huge metropolises. And doing virtual events, I have a bunch of them on my website. If your listeners are interested, anybody can go to them if they have a computer and an internet connection.
As a journalist, and I hope, you know, the future is bright. We hope that you're here in the future as well. As a journalist, you know, you're adept at telling other people's stories. How important was it to tell your own, especially in a book-length format? Because you write personal essays, and we know about your life and different things in your life through your work. But by and large, you're a journalist. This is a big transition.
Yeah, and I think one of the things about writing personal essays is that the personal essays that I wrote tended to be tied to news events, right? You know, like something would happen in the news, and then I would reflect on it in light of my experience. And I think over several years of doing that, and also over those same several years doing investigative projects in which I told other people's stories, I found myself just really introspecting, you know, like what would it mean for me to be able to tell my story outside of any of those strictures, right? Because that's the wonderful thing that authors, that's the wonderful privilege that authors are afforded, is to be able to tell our stories in our own terms. And that, I think, is a lot of what drove the book. It's a lot of what drove my passion for the book and my obsession with it, really, you know, with writing it and just getting everything in it right. Because for so long, it was very difficult for me to be able to tell my story on my own terms.
Yeah. The title of the book, Fairest, has a double meaning. On one hand, it can refer to skin color. On the other hand, it can be an invitation to consider what's fair or what's just. We're in a time today where people are protesting a killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. Your book talks a lot about colorism and racism. So I want to give you an opportunity to talk about race in America right now. But first, I want to go back to your childhood, when your albinism makes you special in the Philippines and other at the same time. What do you understand now that you're an adult about being a sun child that you didn't understand back then?
The thing that I certainly understand now that I didn't understand back then is that my grandmother, who was a really important figure in my life, really protected me from people calling me freakish or aberrant or abnormal by insisting that I was special because I was white and that I had blonde hair. And I think that I held on to that image of myself as special and better because of those qualities. And the thing that I know now is that, and the thing that I think is a lifelong project for me to let go, is for me to be able to stand up for myself as a person without having to rely on that image of myself as a beautiful, blonde, light-skinned person, because that image is deeply rooted in racism, in the idea that whiteness and white people are inherently better than brown people, which is not true.
You also write about just wearing makeup after you transition to being a woman and embracing things that are traditionally considered feminine, and then also saying, you know, is that what I need, you know, today? Is that what I need tomorrow? You've thought more about these things than most people consider in a lifetime. But tell me a little bit about your relationship with fashion and makeup and cosmetics and the image of the American woman and who she is supposed to be.
Certainly, when I began to transition, really the perception of myself as a beautiful woman catalyzed my transition, right? Like I was in my early 20s. And all of a sudden, you know, the physical qualities that I had, which seemed, you know, which were ordinary to people in an American context when I was a gay man, suddenly, you know, kind of like being waifish and with long blonde hair and exotic features was really attractive to people when I transitioned. And I think I held on to that, you know, it was almost like I needed that lifeline to be able to get me towards my gender, towards, you know, to give me the courage to be able to transition. But then over the next 2 years, I just realized that that wasn't actually, like, A, it wasn't what I needed, but also B, it wasn't the most satisfying part of being a woman for me, right? That there were so many other more substantial reasons for why I so gravitate towards womanhood, including, you know, like being with other women, including fighting for women's equality, both of which, you know, which I'm extremely committed to. And so over time, I found myself really letting go of the makeup. And that was the period of time that I was in when I was working on the book. And then subsequently, I, you know, have more recently been able to have a more settled relationship with, you know, with sort of gussying up again after that period, because now I have a much better sense that when I do it, I just do it for myself for fun. I'm not doing it in order to bolster my self-esteem or, you know, make myself look attractive to other people.
Or meet an expectation, a professional expectation, for example.
Exactly.
Yeah. Let's tell the story, if you would, about the first time you're a student at Harvard and they have a tradition of a drag night. And this is the first time where you're really invited to put on women's clothes. And take us back to, can you remember that day? And tell us the story of what you discovered on that day, not only about yourself, but about how the world would immediately see you.
Yeah, so unlike a lot of other trans women, I was not really attracted to dressing up as a girl. I was attracted to fantasizing about being a girl, but somehow that did not extend to me dressing up. So it wasn't until Halloween of my sophomore year at Harvard, there's this tradition called Drag Night in my house, Adam's house, where, you know, everybody dressed in drag for the evening, for that Saturday evening's dinner. And then I found myself in a friend's room, you know, like being being shown clothes that for me to try on. And you know, I tried on this black dress, and I thought to myself, oh, like I don't look, you know, like I don't look that bad, right? But when I went down to the, you know, to the dining hall, because of the fact that I am Asian, but people perceive me as white, it became immediately clear to me that me putting on a dress was really different from other men putting on a dress, because the other men putting on a dress look, you know, they had, you know, body hair, some of them had stubble, you know, like I had, you know, practically no body hair. And then also, like, I was, you know, I am 5'5", right? So my proportions were much more in keeping with what people imagine if people thought that I was white, what people imagine white women would be. And then later that night, I went clubbing. And then on my way home, there was this group of guys who were, the thing that I remember about it was that they had this like really big car, which I really associate with kind of like old movies and just sort of like masculinity. And they started catcalling me. And like all of my actions like preceded conscious thought, you know, like it was just like, okay, like these guys are catcalling me. And then I made the mistake of turning around, and then they were inviting me into their car, and there was just this part of me that took over, that essentially was just like, in order to survive the situation and not get beat up or worse, I have to play this role of a woman to them, even though at that point I'd only perceived myself as a man dressing up as a woman. And I successfully did that and managed to get into my dorm. And I think that that was one of the touch points of my experiences where I was just like, okay, like that was a really, really terrible experience. And yet at the same time, it's also an experience in which these men who didn't know me perceived me as a woman and didn't question their perception of me as a woman. And what does that mean, right? So I think it really propelled a lot of my thoughts around, you know, like around what it would mean to transition. But then also, I think what's really what was important to me as a writer about that scene is that you can have these moments in your life where both of those things can happen, where you can both be afraid and you can, you know, like you can be threatened with violence and yet also get insight and out of it and get an experience that would then be memorable, that would actually help you. I think there's so much work. There's so many things that I read where it's very difficult for people to grapple with multiple realities. But, you know, I'm a person who lives multiple realities every single moment of my life, right? And so that was something that was really important for me to portray in the book.
You mentioned some of the South Dakota State Legislature has tried to pass a variety of bills over the years. So typically when we cover transgender issues on this show, it's often tied to the state legislature. And I wanted to tell you a brief story about a friend of mine I ran into at the grocery store not too long ago, whose daughter, who I've known since kindergarten, was transitioning. And the mother was just grieving, deeply grieving the loss of her daughter. And I'm wondering what your message is to South Dakota families about transition, because they live in a state where that's legally challenged, difficult to have access to, and is, I think, fairly commonly grieved by parents. Should it be grieved? Should transition be celebrated? What's your thoughts to people who are in a family with someone who says, this is the next step to becoming who I really am? You say what then?
I think there are different components of that question, right? Like one of them, a lot of what I hear from parents is I'm grieving because of the fact that I'm afraid of the life that that my child will have after they transition. And that's valid, but it's also, I think, important for parents to know that when they do that, you know, when they grieve for that reason, they're taking on the position of the people who are, you know, like who are going, who they anticipate to be doing cruel things to their child. Whereas in that specific moment, it's so much more important to take the point of view of your child, of this person who is struggling, of this person who wants to be able to make this important shift in their life, to be able to be happier and to be able to, you know, and to be able to live their life in a way that, you know, that better fulfills them. And so that's one component of it. And then the other component of it that I think is really important is that there's no, you know, like obviously our feelings are unconscious. Like we can't, you know, we only have a limited amount of control of them. But just as, you know, it's an imperfect analogy, but just as you, for instance, if somebody had a terminal illness, right, just as you wouldn't, you know, be in a position to then make that illness about your own anticipation of grief over them potentially dying, right? Like, I do think that it's really important for parents to try to shield their children from their grief, because they're making their the transition of the child about them when their child is dealing with so much more than, you know, so much more than they could imagine, right? And so it might be, you know, like the best strategy might be to be able to go to a support group or to talk to other parents, but to really try to be affirming and supportive of their child.
Keith Braveheart is an art instructor at Oglala Lakota College. He, like most other teachers, had to continue with his students online to finish the school year. He says the COVID-19 pandemic has affected him both as an educator and an artist. He joined Lawyer for a conversation about art during the pandemic.
Braveheart is well known for working with young Native American artists at USD's annual Oscar Howe Summer Art Institute. Over the past few months, he's had to make adjustments to online education as a way to help his students succeed. He's also felt the disappointment of having art shows and exhibitions canceled or postponed. But we are glad that we can spend a few minutes with him this morning. Keith, welcome back to In the Moment. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity to return.
This is such an interesting time to be alive, which might be an understatement, and I'm wondering if it is informing your art and the art of your students as people sort of see the world in new ways and deal with their own isolation. What are you seeing about how it's informing artists in their process in general?
I think that it is indeed a very critical time, and I think a lot of us are engaged with the world more so through technologies, and that's something that's been there, but I think now it's something where it's just another sense of seeing the world and feeling the world. But I think that for artists and for people who are creative, I think that it's really a time to reflect on those critical viewpoints and those moments that could be critical that really lead to some sort of action in the long run. I think that people are very inspired just by, you know, what's going on in the world. You know, maybe I think before these social distancing kind of attributes and things that we are very much necessity now. They were more so as like maybe entertainment or just things that were for simple distraction. Whereas now I think people are looking further and finding these really authentic reflections of the world that they exist within. And for, again, creative artists, that's content. And that's going to lead to some sort of more, I think, uplifted artwork. Very, very strong expression. But it's not also limited to just only creatives or artists. I think that just people in general, communities, they're also finding creativity as an outlet to kind of balance out all of this reception to the world that's happening around them, especially through these heightened technologies.
I think it's children's illustrator Mo Willems who said, "The scientists will get us out of this, but it's the artists who will get us through this." And I think that speaks to, you know, your thoughts there on, in some ways, all of us have discovered our own artistic expression. And that's very much part of what you teach in a lot of ways, not only to teach students to become professional artists, but to just teach cultural expression and self-expression and exploration. It's not just that there are some people who are artists and the rest of us aren't, right?
I believe so. I feel like that's a philosophy that I really hold dear, is that art can mean so many different things. And when you allow conversation to develop, you can make time to listen to others and maybe encourage through that listening, and then maybe start to kind of build words that can start to enhance that encouragement so that others may start to look at the world differently and really start to challenge their perceptions or assumptions of what is art. And I mean, there is a field of art, there is a context of art history, and there's different spheres within art, but I think that expression is something that's just natural to every person. You know, we're all born with this urgency to be expressive. When we're little kids, we pick up something to make a mark with, or we start banging on pots and start singing, things like that. It's not until much later on in life where we kind of get a little bit more broken from that natural way of just being a person. And I think that we can return to that later. And I think people still hold on to these different kind of outlets that are very creative and very positive and very, I think, expressive. But we just maybe not making time to have a really critical moment to see, is this art, you know? And in a way, it's really about humanities. You know, you're making time to look at other perspectives and really try to welcome others into your space and into your life, I guess.
Yeah. You help students at Oglala Lakota College, at the Oscar Howe Summer Art Institute at USD, at Racing Magpie, at other, you know, workshops and community events. Do you see people come up against those obstacles of confidence or doubt or technique or skill? Or what are some of the obstacles you see people face, young artists that you're working with as a guide or a mentor or a teacher? And how do you help them get past them?
Yeah, thank you for bringing up all of those organizations, and they're very great relatives to work with. I do have a lot of appreciation for USD and the Oscar Howe Summer Art Institute, which has its legacy there, plus my new institute of the Oglala Lakota College, but also Racing Magpie, who are doing just great work out here in our western South Dakota area. But when I work with anybody, but primarily when I'm working with youth, I feel like it's really about making time to just encourage. And I think that as artists, we're more so trained in observational skills. We have really kind of honed in on seeing something or even looking beyond the normal, the overlooked, even listening. We are trained in active listening, where we can listen to something and we can find a muse within it. And I think that when we apply that to individuals and to our students, you know, our community, we really start to see that there's a lot more out there. And I think that that's something that's really exciting for me as an artist at this point in my career, because I love the unpredictability of that. I love to see what might happen, and also be challenged by what I didn't expect. And really, I think just embrace that there's so much diversity when we start to open up this conversation about what can art be, and how is it so unique to our, you know, our communities, you know, our relatives, our homelands. All of that stuff brings so much unique beauty, and that can't be recreated. And I think that that's what stands out within our region of the Northern Plains. But to me, it just always comes back to just making time to remember that I appreciate art. I see myself as somebody who appreciates viewing art first before making it. So if that lets me kind of distance myself from my ego of being an artist, that's great, because I can make time to sit there and appreciate a young artist who's up and coming, or somebody who might not have the courage yet to call themselves an artist in their first attempt, and then just really try to help build that self-esteem, confidence that they can go further beyond, or maybe start to open up their possibilities to engage with more critical type of conversations or opportunities.
I think that's huge. Just going back to that, that love of art, that appreciation of art, and expanding how you think about it. That's wise advice that anybody can put in their pocket if they're feeling frustrated or stuck. It's a difficult time to market and sell art, to collect art. There's the shows that we normally have that we look forward to, the travel for those shows, many are canceled or postponed. Is the Red Cloud show going forward in June in Pine Ridge, though?
Yes, it is. And I believe that may be one of the only, if not the only, show that I'm aware of that is still moving forward. And I know that they've adjusted their platform, and it's going to be really more safe social distancing protocols. But I know that I've took my work over there, and I thought of it as really a good opportunity to further that encouragement. You really want to support the arts now, and I think in this particular time, more so than maybe in the past. And then really kind of, for me, I believe getting past beyond just only the market aspect of it, to really just say that, you know, here's what I can contribute. And I know that this is something that is very special and dear to me. And I want to give it to you as best as I can, in the hopes of trying to support this effort and just this synergy that we're all coming together to do this, you know, for the love of it. But I do hope that other artists are very successful. I do hope that there's a lot of support that comes within just financially helping artists out in this time. Since, I mean, the statistics are out there, and how many artists are affected by this pandemic, and how many have relied on these sources of income, and now they're taking a big loss. So just to listeners who may be listening, I think that it's really something to just put out there as a nice word to think about how you might be supportive to artists. And maybe it's not always buying artwork, but maybe it's also just making time to have some sort of conversation. I think now is a good time for a conversation as well.
You can find redcloudart.show is where you can find more information about the Red Cloud Indian Art Show. It opens on June 6th at the Heritage Center in Pine Ridge. What will you? What kind of work will you have there?
Well, I have a few little smaller pieces, and I've actually just kind of have fun. I always look forward to that venue, because it's in my homeland. It's here on my Oglala Oyate, you know, on our land. So I know a lot of the people who would come to it normally might not engage with art in a different gallery context, but here they come into it and they might see representation of themselves, or something that might make them think a little bit differently as far as how do they view art, and how do they start to attempt to maybe gain some sort of ownership over their art and culture. So I usually include imagery that really pronounces our cultural identity, but then also contemporary reflection. And I also like to talk about, you know, what's happening currently as well, too. So I actually have a portrait. It's called The Banished Portrait. And you'll find that there as well, too.
You can find Keith Braveheart's art online as well at keithbraveheart.com. He's just one of my favorite artists, Keith, to talk to, and the work that you're doing. And one of the exciting things about living in South Dakota right now and seeing that the work you do and so with so many other artists is just the influence that you have as well. And it's really it's an honor to watch that unfold and sort of see that spread as well. Every time we talk to you, it's a delight. Keith, thank you so much for being here. We appreciate your time.
No, thank you very much. I really appreciate all those kind words and just all the work that you guys do as well, too. So thank you very much.
That's the show for this week. Thank you for joining us. If you have a story idea, send an email to inthemoment@sdpb.org. For Lori Walsh, Chris Loffrey, I'm Josh Heyer. Thank you for listening.